All right, everybody.
Welcome, everybody, to the show Life's a Banquet, the show that's edible, spreadable, and Zara.
Horrible.
Starring your hosts, me, Brendan Scott, and
me, Zara Tangora.
A show about ostriches, wine, and dough.
I'm drunk.
Always. Life's a banquet, life's a banquet, life's a banquet, banquet.
The podcast you have reached,
Life's a Banquet,
is no longer in service. The new podcast is called
Banquet's a Life,
starring your hosts,
Zara
Tangora and Breton Scott. Life's a Banquet is a podcast about all things edible, spreadable, and pourable.
And the highs and lows of those things. And one day, that tagline will come out correctly.
Exactly. About the high. Welcome to Life's a Banquet, the podcast that's edible,
spreadable, and pourable. Did I say it right?
No!
Let's introduce ourselves. My name is Breton Scott, and I live in Brooklyn, and I used to own a restaurant. I've worked in restaurants. I cook. I do all kinds of fun stuff in the food and beverage world. Pretty much everything. Since the day I was born.
Came into this world washing a pan.
Yeah, pretty much with... I prefer Don Applescent. That's what I said.
I'm Zara Tangora, and y'all already know everything about me because I'm world famous, so just Google it. No big deal. Bye.
It's really funny because I'm Google and your name's not coming up.
Oh, yeah. It's really interesting. You just have to spell it with in Wingdings. Yeah. So if you spell in Wingdings, it comes right up immediately.
Oh, there yeah. You are.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
My parents
famous.
Were very, like, kind of nerdy when I was growing up. They're like, let's spell her name in Wingdings. That's hard for me to say. Yeah. Wingdings. Wingdings.
Well, 90s are coming back with a flair.
I'm Zara. I used to be a chef. I didn't know anything about cooking before that. Now I do, kind of. And I like Breton. He's my friend. We do a podcast together. We're silly. He's staring right at me. Almost as like he's staring through my soul right now and kind of judging everything I'm saying.
I'm actually mimicking my cat Sparkles, who is definitely also a world famous cat.
His name
is Sparkles. And
not spelled in Wingdings.
He's working on a YouTube page, but I've learned from him that if you just stare blankly into just like right past.
I feel like you have my like control over me right now at this point.
I've let go.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Ooh. So Zara and I still work together. We collaborate on projects and cooking and
we do private catering.
We do real private catering. Feel free to ask us to come into your house and we'll slip
private.
Into something more comfortable. And
I'll take off my bikini bottoms.
That's right. And I'll bake you up the best lemon cake you've ever had in your life.
So what's going on? We did a lot of fun stuff this week. We went to a fabulous restaurant last night in my hometown of Huntington.
Saldi's.
It's on the North Shore of Long Island.
Where's the North Shore of Long Island,
Zara? The North Shore of Long Island, Breton, is about right said Sensa in the middle. So you're between where, you know, the city starts on the left, Montauk, you got on the right. So if you go
Wait,
on the
I'm
North
confused.
Shore. Now listen. I'm giving you Long Island style directions
All right.
here.
Oh, yeah,
okay?
That's right.
You take the LIE.
Okay. You
get off at Huntington. Oh, actually, you get off at 106, 107. Mm-hmm. If you want to take the shortcut, then you go over to Huntington. It's on the North Shore. And yeah.
Wow.
Bing, bang, boom. There you are. So we went to Saldi's, an amazing Italian-American restaurant that is the nephew or cousin or stepchild restaurant of my favorite place growing up, which was called J&J's, which is now no longer. But that was a place that my parents went. It was a big part of my childhood. And this is kind of a little fancy, like, I shouldn't say fancy, but J&J was a real dump. And this place is like, you know.
I thought it was a real dump.
No, that was a real dumpy dump. Dumparoo.
Dumparoo. I visited Zara yesterday.
Yeah, it was fun.
I came all the way from Brooklyn out to Long Island is what I've learned. I was like, oh, I'm from Wisconsin. I'm like, we're going up to Long Island.
Oh, no, you go out to Long Island. And then you're on the island. Thank you, Jerry Seinfeld.
And then suddenly, exactly. And then suddenly I found myself in Huntington. And I wanted that. All I wanted was fried calamari all day. I was like, I know that you should come to Long Island. I don't know why. And I act like I'm this old, like, oh, I've been coming to Long Island for years. It really wasn't until I started visiting you. And I fell in love with Long Island. It's the I have a whole musical about it.
They call that getting jolled.
Yeah. It flopped in 1962 and off Broadway. I fell in love with Long Island. Oh, it's really great. George Gershwin collaborated with. No, they didn't. But so anyway,
what do we have at dinner?
Crispy fried calamari.
fried and to a crisp in a good way.
A crisp. It was light, fresh, perfectly battered. I said, this is the best calamari I've had in years. And I asked the waitress for something spicy. And she was a lovely, cute 23-year-old little blonde, probably not 20-year-old. You know, probably a college job.
Yeah.
Summer job. She had to ask if they had Beefeater gin. You know, like,
yes.
She was like, oh, sure, he knows. Anyway, and I asked her for something spicy, and she gave me a really gorgeous, she goes, oh, I mean, I could bring you chili flake. And I said, like, something special.
You're like, try like, again,
and
sister.
And she goes, oh, I happen to have some warm sliced hot cherry peppers in a lovely arrabbiata sauce. And I said, yeah, like, yes, why wouldn't you just bring that to me in the first place?
Bing, 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 bing.
Bing, bing, and it was delicious.
It was very good. It was wonderful. Very good. We had rigatoni alla vacca.
Sole francese. Was it francese?
Yeah, it was so.
By the way, if anybody doesn't know what francese is, because it's, I actually didn't hear a whole lot about it, but Zara, tell us what francese is, which I fell in love with.
Yeah, francese, or franchise, as my mother says.
You're really trying to be fancy.
She goes, a franchise. It's really good. It's just like egg battered. You can have veal franchise. You can have shrimp franchise, chicken franchise. You can really franchise anything you want. And so it's
sexy.
I use the franchise batter on other things. So really, it's just that you do an egg batter. So a little bit of flour on whatever protein or anything you pick.
So it gets a little
flour, then egg, then directly in the pan. So it's not like breadcrumby. It's just kind of like a little puffy, like.
Got
a little omelette-y on the
little
outside.
Omelette-y almost.
Right. And then franchise sauce. Franchise sauce. Mm-hmm. Is like a lemon and butter and white wine.
So it's really simple.
Finished I with think curly parsley.
The way that I sort of described it when I first had it, I said, oh, this kind of reminds me a little of that egg foo young kind of texture on the outside, but lighter and fluffier and delicious.
Yeah, well, that's proof that kind of culturally, you know, every different food culture has extreme similarities, right?
Yeah, I guess so. That's
it was very good. One of the things I enjoyed most is that you ordered a gin martini. Of course, I would have joined you, but I was driving. So I just sipped off of yours. I sipped off of some of the gin that fell into the bread basket.
The first thing I did, I cheered, was knocked out 2 ounces of my 8-ounce martini.
But they did the kind of cute, kitschy thing where they bring the mini shaker to the table.
Oh my God, a mini shaker. And I said, I'm telling you.
Pure class.
Late 80s and 90s is full on in swing everywhere.
Exactly. And I think like instead of just pushing that aside and be like, oh no, like places like that aren't cool. You know what? That's the coolest kind of place.
I want
because there's no pretension.
Yeah.
I like that.
Anyway, so that was delicious. It was wonderful. Oh, you know what I wanted to talk to everybody about?
Yes, please.
Was the clam shack. Okay.
Bigelow's.
So suddenly
should I do a geography lesson also about Bigelow's though before we start, since I am the authority in Long Island driving?
Okay, here we go. So then, all right, another direction.
Exactly. So what you do is you're going to take the LIE and then you're going to get off at the Meadowbrook Parkway and you go. So we went to Robert Moses and then we kind of went back. We doubled back.
Robert Moses Beach is
like before Fire Island.
Yeah, and it's this gorgeous, long stretch of beach that actually is man-made.
Really?
Yeah, they man-made half the park and they dredged sand over.
Man-made the man-made beach?
Yes, so Robert Moses is a fabulous park, which is also a beach.
Nice.
Has
a
theater, and it's probably like an hour and 20-minute drive from New York City.
It's almost exactly
right. It's really
right.
Close. You can take a bus, you can take a train, you can take a plane,
you can
take
a
helicopter. Yes, to be so in sync.
We're so amazing. Okay, listen, but Rockville Center, South Shore of Long Island, again, kind of in dead middle of the island, but like you're on the South Shore. Anyway, not a typical place you'd find a seafood shack.
For those of us from the Midwest or just west of the East, it's very quick to get to, and it's beautiful and has white sand beaches with like a gorgeous
not
horizon.
Rockville Center.
Not Rockville.
Don't confuse people. No. They're going to get on the train to Rockville Center and be very disappointed.
They get off in Rockville Center, but like, I listened to your podcast and I got off and I'm looking for the clam shack near the sandy beaches.
Oh, and they're like, I don't like Rockville Center.
Okay, so we pull up to this clam shack, and I've been obsessed for everybody that is listening. I've been obsessed with clam shacks. I was talking to my friend from the South Shore of Long Island. Mary from Sayville, which is right by Fire Island. And anyway, she said, oh, Breton, you should open up a clam shack, but really do it well.
Yeah.
And so I start Googling and Pinteresting all these wonderful places in the East Coast that I want to check out. Anyway, there's tons of clam shacks. And I started looking and I created a list. And this was one of them on the list.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. That was the one that was actually the first one, because I saw the entrance of the bar has kind of that crisscross window.
Yeah.
And the bar was built in 1939 and is 100% original. And so we walked in And I was skeptical because I thought, you know what? It's in the middle of a strip mall.
It was on Sunrise Highway. I mean, again, for the people not from Long Island.
It was a bad highway. You
know, it's not. It's a kind of a misnomer.
Yeah. Some car dealerships, maybe a mall, maybe some like, I don't know, maybe some other chain stores. And then this clam shack. But we walked in and they had a gorgeous kind of curvy bar with that. A cubby hole in the bar. I've never seen that in my life.
A gentleman's cubby hole.
A gentleman's cubby hole.
It's only big enough for a watch, wallet, and keys. Mm-hmm. Ladies, you're out of luck. Watch, you got a big purse.
Spectacles, testicles, wallet, and watch. Double check it before you go out.
Exactly. That's what we always say here on Life's Banquet. Yes. But anyway, the clams.
Clams. Okay. So I was open and I was hungry. We had spent the day at the beach and I thought, you know, this is the perfect time to get an ice cold beer and some fried clams. But a question. Now, this is because I'm new to the East Coast as of 11 years ago. But Ipswich whole belly clams fried or clam strips?
It depends who you're dining with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like an Ipswich clam. I like a whole belly clam because I like things that are kind of yucky and, you know, like, well, I mean, quote unquote yucky. I like every kind of offal. I like raw oysters. You know, I'll basically eat mud right out of the ground. If you put enough vinegar on it. However, not everybody likes that. And a clam strip is pretty much crowd pleasing as long as they're not like overdone and like, crazy chewy.
Well, so I had asked our lovely, lovely bartender, this gentleman. And, you know, I said, hey, what do you recommend? You know, that's kind of, you know, sometimes when people ask obvious questions, what do you recommend? The French fries or the onion rings?
Right.
Those are really different.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that with the clams.
Yeah.
But he gave a wonderful, wonderful description.
He did.
And he said this. Ready? No, yes. He said this. He just said, listen, you know, Ipswich whole belly clams is the whole clam. It's a little bit larger. It's a little bit juicier. And he said, it's kind of like, have you ever had a fried oyster? It's kind of like you get that.
Mm-hmm.
You get the whole flavor.
Yeah, the whole shabizzle. Yeah.
And the clam strips are just a little bit more. Like,
it's a crab pleaser.
Yeah. Crab, clam popcorn,
if
you will.
Yes. Or popcorn clams.
Well, we went with the strips.
We did. And they were great.
And they've served a whole tub of tartar sauce that was at every single place met
perfectly
at the bar.
perfectly chilled,
perfectly tangy, didn't have too much clove or any other non-spices that shouldn't be in.
Very straightforward. I think that I probably ate a full cup of tartar sauce.
He refilled it and we each ate 8 ounces.
It was delicious. I loved every second of it.
They changed the oil frequently and it was fantastic, and I've never felt better after fried food in my life.
It was great. Definitely go.
I'm going up to Midtown.
Okay.
And I want one of those Greek pastries.
Oh, my God.
From Poseidon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where I coincidentally get the best phyllo pastry.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say you were looking to have something at Flavortown.
What's Flavortown?
It's Guy Fieri's restaurant, excuse me.
No, it closed.
Oh.
Oh, wait.
Well, there's still, I feel like you can still walk in and kind of pick something out of the walk-in. You break in. This is what you do. You go in the back. You knock 3 times. There's a bunch of old employees that still work there, and they shuffle you out some Flavortown nachos with donkey head sauce and butt
cream. Guy Fieri had the worst review in the New York Times. Did you ever read it?
Of course. Everyone's read it.
It's the worst thing. And it's
the worst.
Closed.
Don't you think it was a little bit like, I don't know. I didn't quite, like, I thought it was funny, like everyone else, like, oh, it's so funny.
Pete Wells wrote it,
yeah. But I'm kind of like, my takeaway from it was, you know how many people wait around for a New York Times review who like try and try and open these restaurants? And I mean, we could do a whole episode about
that
New York Times reviews
most
in general.
Controversial review of
That's
any
like,
reviews.
What a waste. What a waste of everyone's time.
Yeah.
I just think it being the review for the week was a waste of time to like be cruel to somebody.
I agree.
It's just like,
it was very.
Give me a break.
It was
Pete Wells, if you're listening, I'm just kidding. I
love you,
Wells, darling. You're fabulous.
Luckily, you can't review us.
This was amazing. Some corrections that I want to make from a couple of past shows. I've been listening to them and judging myself and relentlessly. And I lock myself in the closet at night and don't allow myself any food or water or beverages or air. Because I'm embarrassed about mistakes I've made on the show, and I'm willing to cop to them. So in our Heinz episode, I said that Warren Buffett bought Heinz for like $23 billion, some like ridiculous number. It's really $23 billion.
$23 billion.
Yeah.
You're
so
correct.
Heinz ketchup sold for $23 billion, not $230 billion. Cardoon, we were talking about. I said it's a tuber. It's really a thistle. Eating a dead lobster, I just want to clarify about that. What I meant by not eating a dead lobster is, I mean, if you get one and it's died of natural causes, you don't want to cook it.
That makes sense. Yeah,
one, I didn't think obviously about that. We always eat a dead lobster. Like, we eat them, they die of natural causes, or you cook them and then they die. The same thing with, like, clams, anything. If you just find a lobster or you get one from your fishmonger and it's died on its own, the same thing with, like, a soft shell crab, you don't want to eat, like, something that's just dead, and then, you know, like, you wouldn't want to cook a pig that just kind of flopped over and died, and then you're like, oh, I'll eat this. That's how people get trichinosis or trichomoniasis, right. Whatever. Then one last thing that I want to mention. We do a lot of stories on this podcast about things like Heinz ketchup. Earlier we mentioned Kraft. Mm-hmm. We talked about KFC. We don't endorse those companies. We don't like what they do to the world. We don't like their global impact. We don't like we don't recommend eating tons of processed foods. We're very much involved in...
But Kraft Foods owns a lot of things.
Of course. I'm just saying...
I used to work for Kraft Foods.
We chat about this stuff, but we don't chat about it because we're ignorant or because we like it or because we don't know that it's bad. Just so you know, we tell all kinds of stories, but we're not into
Zara uses Heinz ketchup.
Of course.
And so do I sometimes, but I actually like Sir Kensington's.
I don't mean that we're, like, above eating Cheetos or we're above eating ketchup. I'm just saying... We're not, like, sitting here ignorant to its impact on the world and recommending that you run out to KFC and that's, like, the coolest place and we don't get what it does. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
We get it.
We get it.
And we love it. A couple other things that I really wanted to mention, which are non-food related but very inspirational.
Yes.
Sorry, kiddos. You might miss this because this is going to air right towards the end of the show. But if it appears and pops up in another city, I think it's traveling. The David Bowie exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum.
One of the most
inspiring things ever. I'm pretty sure David Bowie didn't eat food at all. So, like,
He was very thin.
He was very thin. And just, can you picture him eating?
Well, now, I was actually going to bring this up. Because I was at the David Bowie exhibit also, which I just went to on Monday.
Davy Jones.
And so I'm perusing the exhibit, and he has all this gorgeous artwork, handwritten stuff that he painted storyboards for ideas that he had. Everything was so intricate. And I came across a hand-painted menu, which was from one of his favorite restaurants when he lived in Berlin. And I was going to take a picture of it.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, there was a hand-painted menu. And on the menu, the dessert was a plum tort or something. I can't remember. Anyway, it was a hand painted gorgeous menu he created for the restaurant.
That's amazing.
So, and he said he ate there all the time.
Oh, well, I guess that I'm wrong. Obviously he ate.
He ate one singular muscle, one muscle, and he ate one teaspoon per day of plum tort.
Oh, David Bowie. The
I
best.
I don't know if he did.
It was really special and really wonderful and very inspiring. And just reminded me a little bit about, this is kind of an odd segue into our topic for today, but a segue nonetheless. It kind of reminded me about...
A segue scooter, I love those.
Got me to thinking about New York, which is our home and has been my home since I was... Oh, geez, I'm very old now. Oh, my God.
Now you're 84.
Oh, my God. It's been my home for 16 years. And I grew up in Long Island, as everybody on the planet knows by now. And just like... You know, obviously, Bowie wasn't from New York, but he spent a lot of time
here.
But
he ended up making it his home here.
Exactly. And it made me start thinking about how brave he was, how interesting he was, and how, you know, he was influenced by all these different things. And that's what New York is. And then in a grander scheme, even though there are certainly parts of the country that are a little bit more rigid than others, the country is that as well. And we're going through this horrible time for a lot of people, consider it to be a horrible time. Personally, I do. I know that you do as well, where we're kind of not really appreciating diversity very much and not really appreciating the influences of people from other countries and different genders and different sects of ideas and, you know, the whole gamut of difference.
The flip side of that is that there are probably more than half the population that actually is.
Of course, absolutely.
And we must not let that overshadow.
Absolutely. But we're being, you know, the people in charge, I don't even want to say said person's name, is, you know, we're getting messages, and especially young kids.
Somebody's in charge.
Ding, ding, ding.
Ba-dum-bum-bum.
Good one. We're getting messages that other is bad, that people who are not like us are bad. And it made me start thinking also about, you know, I'm the granddaughter of several immigrants. I had grandparents who immigrated from Italy, from Russia, and from Hungary, and my grandmother was half Hungarian, half Yugoslavian.
What the heck would America be eating if we didn't have immigrants?
Exactly. Egg-freaking-zactly.
And
so,
illegal immigrants, too. Yeah. I mean,
what do you think this part of the world, this part of our country would be like without Jewish immigrants?
Well, I think it would be far less delicious and far less neurotic. And far less colorful.
So I really appreciate my heritage, and I appreciate very much living in New York City. We're super, super lucky being here. We get to go to Chinatown. We get to go to, you know, I mean, I want to say Little Italy, although that's not really.
You live in Little Italy.
This is the real Little Italy in Carroll Gardens here, which is in kind of South Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I really wanted to kind of think about a story I could tell that was my own personal story, but still tied to the immigration issue that we're dealing with right now. So I sat down with my mom and asked her about what it was like being raised Jewish.
Well, in actuality, I did experience a lot of anti-Semitism
and
growing
actually,
up.
Pardon me, what was the year? What is the
this
year
would
range
be
we're talking about?
In the mid-60s.
Okay, great. In Long Island.
So I was, right. I moved into a neighborhood where there really were very few Jewish families. And I remember it was before Jewish holidays were given as a day off in schools.
Okay.
And the teacher would say, now who's going to be off for the Jewish holiday? And I would raise my hand and I looked around and no one else raised their hand. And I remember being made fun of. And I'll actually tell a really kind of bad story.
Yeah, please.
Which is that I remember being at a game once.
Yeah.
There was a sports game, and a penny was on the floor, and somebody looked at me and say, you're a cheap Jew, why don't you pick it up? And I remember feeling so bad and so alone and isolated. It was really hard. It was hard. I experienced anti-Semitism, and it was hard.
So I want to talk to you guys today about one of my favorite Jewish delicacies and combinations, bagels and lox.
Oh, bagels.
And the bagels and lox. Now,
I like bagels.
Surprising tidbit, bagels and lox is not a Jewish, neither thing is like traditionally Jewish. Neither thing came from necessarily.
From, yeah, exactly.
Bagels, a little bit more, we'll get into that. Lox, not so much, we'll get into that. And cream cheese, definitely not. But I think it's awesome because it's a really, really good example of how something that people who immigrated here made their own and then now is like, you know, nationally and internationally renowned as one of America's favorite foods.
I mean, it's
and the world's favorite foods.
And it makes New York City
have a nosh.
Yeah,
exactly. So a couple fun facts here. Also want to start off by saying that I got most of my information from Wikipedia and also a really great article on the now no longer Meat Paper magazine. It was an online magazine. Heather Smith for Meat Paper. I got a lot of info from there.
Meat Paper. It sounds delicious.
I mean, what if paper was actually made of meat?
I think they would call that.
There'd be no libraries, right?
Exactly.
Bookstores. You'd have to. All the bookstores would have to be refrigerated really well. So 40% of the world's Jewish population currently lives in the U.S., which I thought was very shocking.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot of Jews. Yeah, and I can say that because I'm Jewish. So if you're offended by my doling out the use of Jews, it's fine for me.
That's right, but I can't.
I'm a
nasty Catholic.
No, I'm a nasty... No.
Oh, no, no.
No.
I only eat communion and
drink the blood
and Carlo Rossi wine.
Drink the blood of Christ and stay on your side of the table,
right.
Okay?
Drinking blood, pardon me.
So 1.1 million people alone in the five boroughs of New York City are Jewish. And that's about 8% of the city. So people, you know, in their stereotypes of New York City, a lot of times like, oh, you know, oi, you're very Jewish. And like Jewish ladies, you know, being, I want my brisket lean. And that's a stereotype for a reason, because there is a lot of Jewish people here. And thank goodness for that. Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
David's.
The first Jews came to America via New York City, which at the time was called New Amsterdam. There was 23 of them in the year 1654.
Those Dutch.
And they were Brazilian.
Brazilian
Jews.
Yeah,
they were Sephardic Jews who had escaped Portugal. And they then went to Brazil and then came to New York. And Peter Stuyvesant, who was the governor at the time, The governor?
Yeah, he had that property in the East Village.
Right. Stuyvesant town.
Yeah.
And he had Bedford, a whole farm Stuyvesant. There.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, there's a lot of Stuyvesant. If you're not from New York, everything is Stuyvesant this, Stuyvesant that.
And it looks like it's Stuyvesant.
Stuyvesant. But you know what? He was not nice to these poor 23 Jews. He taxed them so heavily that they left. And there wasn't really a big kind of Jewish immigration again until 1880 when Alexander II was assassinated in Russia. And they say it was by Jewish people, and it really like created a huge fury of anti-Semitism in Russia at the time. So then you got a lot of Jewish immigrants coming over. So I think in the year 1881, there was about 1 million Jews that immigrated to New York City alone.
Can you imagine?
In the 1880s? I mean, it's crazy.
I picture the harbors. They just must have been bustling.
Yeah.
Think of like when you get off. I wonder what they.
It's like getting off the. Are you going to say something about like getting off the subway?
It's like getting off at Grand Central. It'd be like, oh my gosh, there's so many people and pretzels and hot dogs. I don't know. I pictured like their pretzel people are still there in like 1880. You get off, you're like, oh my gosh. And
the umbrella guy is there. He's like, anyone need an umbrella? Welcome to America. It rains a lot. Yeah. So there was like 1 million Jews that came from Russia and Eastern Europe in general during the late 1800s. A lot of anti-Semitism in the places they were immigrating from, but also in New York City. I mean, it was obviously a lot better, but there was still really hard for them to like get jobs. People were kind of, you know, not being extremely welcoming, not unsimilar to what's happening today.
Well, my first thought is that anti-Semitism is an age old, it's centuries old.
Yeah.
And certainly my mom is a Holocaust survivor. I mean, her family died in a concentration camp. So, and she was a refugee. So anti-Semitism was very much a part of my reality.
But the Jewish people at the time just made their own community. So like, we're going to make our own hospitals. We're going to make our own businesses. We're going to have really like tight-knit community and synagogues and social centers and clubs and,
oh yeah, just stick together.
And the like. And so they kind of all settled in tenements in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which is still a very Jewish neighborhood to this day.
You know, my father really grew up the sort of New York immigrant tenement lifestyle, grew up on the Lower East Side and in Williamsburg. You know, that was his life.
The German Jews who were arriving around then were a little bit more fussy and they were rich, and they decided that they were going to just go kvetch, which for all of you Gentiles kvetch means complain.
Oh, so that's, I'm a kvetcher.
Exactly. Oh, yes.
Somebody said, oh God, I would never want to be a schnorr.
A schnorr, yeah.
Do you know what a schnorr is?
It's like a boar.
No, it's not. A schnorr.
I mean, no, it's not.
No, it's not. Schnorr is according to him, and I did have
it. It sounds like boar.
It's somebody that's a day short and a day late and a dollar short.
Oh, really? Well, let's take this pause, actually. I'm going to finish my story in just 1 second, but it reminds me that I did want to share with you guys some other popular Jewish phrases that these people brought over. These people. My people brought over.
These people. We would not be saying.
Mensch, which is obviously someone who's like an honorable person. Do you guys ever see the movie Supermensch, the documentary?
No.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in another episode. A mensch is like a stand-up guy, a good guy.
So I'm not a mensch.
No,
a
you're
schnorr.
More of a schnorr.
What the f***?
A nosh.
Well, you got to say.
A nosh is something to eat. Like, oh, go have a nosh. Michigas is like crazy.
So I'm also a Michigas.
You're a total Michigas.
I'm a Michigas schnorr.
You're a schnorr Michigas.
Oh, okay.
Schnorr. Nosh is Yiddish.
Wait, you like get a nosh? Oh, yeah. Hey, bro.
Really? I never heard a surfer say, yo, let's catch some nosh. Let's catch some fucking nosh, bro. Let's nosh it up. Yo.
When I was in Newstall, they used to say, like, shred the nor. Like,
yeah,
for
shred
snow.
The nar, and then they get a nosh and a schwitz. They get a nosh and a schwitz.
It's true. That's total mountain living.
You know what else? You might be a Jew because you're also kind of a schlemiel.
What's a schlemiel?
A clumsy person.
I'm all a schnorr schlemiel.
But you're not a schmendrick, which is a stupid jerk.
Oh, thank God. If there's all, I'll be a schnorr before I'm a schmendrick.
Schmaltzy is someone who's corny. Obviously, we all know schmooze, which means to go when you know you're at a party. Oh, well, darling, hello. High heel shoes are beautiful.
Wait, what is schmooze again?
Schmoozing and oozing schnooze.
Okay.
And then a schmuck.
Oh.
Is also
what a schmuck.
Yiddish.
Schmuckers
and schmutz.
And schmucks.
And schmutz.
Schmutz.
Yeah, that's when there's like stuff on the table. Like
oh,
right
like
now.
Oh God,
it's like
schmutz.
Oh, there you got some schmutz on your face.
Wait, what is scooch?
Scooch?
You know when people say like scooch over?
Oh, scooch over? I don't know what that is.
I think scooch over is...
I think that's
gay. You know, whenever I used to bartend, people would always like, could you scooch over a little bit so my friend could come and scooch? And I was like, you mean scoot over? Or do you mean... It was like a Jewish scooch.
Do you mean scoot over, madame?
You know what?
Scoot. I will scoot over. I will not scooch over.
Stop being a schnorr.
You're a schlemiel.
Yeah. Stop being a schlemiel schnorry.
You're getting very Michigas over here.
This is, I'm really excited.
I know.
Bring,
so these are some,
let's bring back
Michigas. These are some words we can all incorporate into our vocabulary, or if you were to use them, now you know where they came from. So anyway, these German Jews moved to the Upper East Side from the Lower East Side. So they kvetch about the Gentiles that were kind of flooding the Lower East Side. They thought they were kind
They're
of like low class. They were, you know, poor, lived in tenements. I don't know if anyone's ever kind of spent time in the Lower East Side. Great place called the Tenement Museum. And
oh, that's
kind
right.
Of
I still haven't been there.
It's really cool. You can learn about how different groups of people, when they first immigrated to this country, lived. I went to the one that was about Russian Jews. I went with my mom. She was really interested in it because she has, you know, half Russian Jewish heritage and half Yugoslavian Jewish heritage. So we went, it was really cool, but they lived in very like cramped, poorly ventilated, poorly lit conditions. It was like very dirty.
Yeah,
there was a lot
horrible.
Of disease. No one would really give them jobs. So like I said, they formed their own communities. They built their own hospitals. Mount Sinai actually used to be called Jews Hospital until they renamed
just
it.
Jews Hospital.
Jews Hospital. And it now it's like the best. Yeah, I'll go to the Jews Hospital. Now everyone's like, yeah, I'll go to the Jews Hospital. That's
I've
the best
been,
hospital
been,
in the whole
yeah.
city.
I went to Mount Sinai to get my knee replacement. That's so... You
exactly.
Hear that.
Or
hear
a hip replacement or an elbow replacement.
Mm-hmm.
There was a ton of fires because they were working in sweatshops. A lot of clothing production. That's what everyone was doing. So that's like what people were working on. Except the other job that was very popular mm-hmm. during that time was baking, particularly bagel baking.
I wonder why bagel baking.
Well, I'll tell you. So while there is a lot of different... theories and kind of opinions and conjecture out there about where bagel making actually began.
It's
in Egyptian hieroglyphs, Egyptian hieroglyphics, I should say, if I want to say it correctly.
I didn't see those when I was there.
Yeah, you, went, bagel. To, you went to Egypt. Didn't you say you thought the pyramids were like just okay?
I don't know.
You're like, nah.
They were kind of
Britain's very hard to impress.
They were kind of crumbly.
He loves a fried clam strip, but if it's perfectly fried, but the pyramids is like whatever.
One thing I'll say about the pyramids, and I promise I won't say anything bad because I'm not kvetching anymore.
Okay.
Starting
you gave
right
up 28 days
after
of no kvetching.
But you go to the pyramids and you're, you know, the ones right near Cairo and they're kind of crumbly. They're not as big as you think. And at the base of the exit is a KFC.
Oh, come on.
Like the KFC is right there.
Get
like,
it together, pyramids.
In Cairo.
I'm shocked.
Anyway,
that.
You should get Fool if you're there, not the KFC. Fool's that chit that
I won't
Fava
be fooled.
Beans.
I'll only eat KFC.
Anyway, back to, okay, so I did not see bagels on the hieroglyphics. I clearly missed it.
So that was one one idea of where it first started. Other people say that it was they were found along the Silk Road. Other people say they were date back
the
to the
Road.
14th century in Italy. One mm-hmm. thing that we know for sure, they're much harder, and they had a hole in the middle for two reasons. One, to represent
well.
The circle of life. Actually, three reasons.
Yeah.
One, so they could carry them on a string.
Honey, you're
and three,
setting me up.
You know, you could put your penis right through it if you were alone in the woods
that was
for
like
a long
the
time.
The real baker's secret was
yeah.
like what they don't know.
They're like, why is there a
all
hole
the
in this?
Like lonely bakers that are in like the hot and they're all sweaty so they can never get laid.
Yeah.
And they just invented the hole. They're like, hey, if you kind of like par bake these things, you can like that's disgusting.
They're like, Shlomo, why is there a hole
anyway,
in the middle
and then
of this
every
roll?
every single bagel eaten until 1890 was actually like a penis.
Hey, there's a hole in this roll.
Anyway, we all know that's the we all know that's the truth.
A
so.
Roll with a hole.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Goodness. But listen,
fucking funny. Okay, wait. So wait, what
okay,
am I going to listen to?
That probably, I bet the Chinese invented it.
I mean, they invented.
They invented everything.
I know.
And they're like, oh, that's the Chinese.
That's
oh,
what yeah. makes the most sense to me.
That's why I love.
I'm sure that the Egyptian hieroglyphics were probably just some kind of sacrificial body part on a string and not actually a bagel.
Yeah, but, it was like a I mean, slice of your duodenum.
Exactly. Who's to say? But what we do know for a fact is that in 1614, in Poland, it was entered into law. They wrote something about bagels in law. It's
the
not
Polish
that interesting. But
took
so
it.
We know that the Polish took it, ran with it. You know, stuck their dicks in it just as much as anyone else throughout time.
Well, I'm Polish.
Well, that's probably
yeah, yeah.
why you know the secret.
Yeah. Passed. Well, it was what my grandfather swore when he died a couple years ago and he was like on his deathbed. He's like, I'll tell you the secret. And I was like, yes, grandfather. But yes, the dark crystal. Yes, the crystal shard is cracked. What? And he's like, the secret is the bagel. That would be, he did. Anyway, God bless you, Louis Spatulski.
Oh, Louis, you and your filthy bagel eating habits and bagel baking
habits.
So
the Polish.
So the Polish, they brought it here. So basically,
I see where we're going.
Yes. So the Polish came over here in the late 1800s, along with a lot of other folks. And then in the early 1900s, more and more Polish people came over. Bagels started being popular.
So they were baking
popular.
In Brick Lane.
Exactly.
So they basically made New York City.
Yeah, and they were working in some bad conditions. It was real serious down there. Like, they were, like, stoking those coal ovens, kind of like Nicolas Cage in Moonstruck. And he's like, what do you want? And he, like, waves his fake hand. That's what everybody was.
But do you love him, Loretta?
I do, Mama.
Well, yeah. What does she say then? She's like, oh.
Nicolas Cage, I'm sorry, is such a disgusting creep. If you're listening, I'm sorry, Nicolas Cage. Don't get your feelings hurt. But that movie, he is so hot in that movie. Literally.
Yeah, he's very...
Literally, he's sweating through the whole thing, so he's hot. And then he's also sexy.
In a yellow-stained tank top. I don't like... A shirt. I don't like to call them the former people. I'm never going to use that word again.
No, that word...
Those are uncool.
We don't use that word anymore.
No.
So that happened. Bagels. Oh, yeah. So... bagels started becoming popular in New York, and they were selling them just like kind of like how we would have pretzels today. They had a form of bagel bakers union.
Do you think they had long sticks that with?
Yeah.
They would just walk in the street and
they did.
On each dowel of wood, there was hot, fresh, like sesame.
Yes.
Pumpernickel
and
bagels.
Poppy seed was very popular. So yeah, they had a form of bagel bakers union. Real crazy because everyone was getting treated so poorly. They were working 16-hour days, sweltering away. People were like passing out and dying.
Like a line cook normally in New York.
Exactly. So nothing much has changed, and my story is completely over. So that happened, and then in the 1800s.
And they didn't
yeah.
have insurance either.
No insurance.
Oh, okay. So nothing's changed.
So also during that period of time, just to place you, put you right there in New York, in 1893, there was the great horse shit crisis.
Oh, I'll never forget it.
Where there was so much horse shit, they couldn't figure out how to get it out. And to get it out, they actually had to bring more horses.
Which brought
more shit.
This reminds me of the Dr. Seuss from How Did I Ever Tell You How Lucky You Are? And he goes, the faster I mowed it, the faster it growed.
Exactly.
Like the more shit they brought out, the more shit they brought in.
Exactly. So picture
it. That's where they came up with like horse shit.
Yeah. Oh, you're full of shit. Horse shit.
Horse shit. This is horse shit. It really was.
That's where the old phrase, I'm up to my ears in horse shit and I can't breathe, came from.
I know. I say that every morning. Every morning, the first things that come out of my mouth are that.
So the picture at the 1895, the streets are covered in horse shit and bagels. Everywhere you look,
hot
a pile
bagels,
of shit covered in bagels.
Coal ashes.
Yeah.
Sweaty,
ash boys.
Sweaty Polish.
Sweaty ash
young
boys.
24-year-old Polish men in tank tops, like blonde hair with like a nice buzz cut.
Yep.
Just like with like bulging biceps, pulling bagels out of this hot oven. Yeah.
Sack of pickles. It was crazy.
You know, my grandmother on my mother's side, she left. My grandfather, the one who was born in Brooklyn, his father sent him to medical school in Hamburg, Germany, where he met my grandmother and fell in love. He had seen Hitler speak at a rally in Berlin, and he was like, "We're getting out of here." And he transferred to do his residency at NYU. She came in August to meet him. It was a sort of huge cultural shock because she grew up with someone with money in Germany and came to, you know, her first vision of New York was the cars on the Belt Parkway out from the boat. And then my grandfather's family picked her up and they went back home to Bensonhurst. And she, you know, she must have been like, oi.
Until the year 1905, and a gentleman named Joel Russ decides to come and pay us a little visit at Ellis Island, and he brought with him some of the traditions from his homeland, Poland.
Poland again.
Poland.
Saving the world.
Of pickling fish. So he's selling pickled herring and dried mushrooms out of a cart, and then decides to open up a storefront. A couple years pass. He opens one storefront. It's an appetizing shop. Just so you guys know, appetizing is how Jewish, basically appetizers, smoked fishes, candies, dried nuts, caviar, stuff like that, pickled fish, pickles. That's how they're referred to in Jewish culture as appetizing.
Appetizing, so it's a present participle. Oh, interesting. My God, I never thought about that.
Not only are you handsome, you are smart.
I actually think that's wrong.
What can't you do?
What's the
no, it's right. Let's just go with it.
Perfect.
It sounds really
love
good.
It. I'm smart.
So in 1920, he ends up opening his permanent location that would stay there for the next over 100 years. Well, yeah, over 100 years. Called Russ and Daughters.
This is it's all come together. It's
we're going
together.
To Russ and Daughters. Russ and Daughters is one of the most spectacular places in the entire world. I remember going in with a boyfriend one time, an ex-boyfriend, should I say, because of this. No, I'm just kidding. We dated for another 2 years.
He ordered a hamburger.
We went into Russ and Daughters on a Sunday. It was super crowded, and he had a panic attack and made us leave. And I should have just dumped him right then and there. He couldn't have.
If you're listening
right now. I can't wait in Russ and Daughters. I was like, you're missing the point of life.
Yeah, you can't. You know what? If you can't eat together.
If you can't wait for a nosh, then what can you do?
Yeah, stop kvetching. Get the heck out of here. You schnorr.
Exactly. Exactly.
Idiot.
So in 1933, he brings his daughters into the business and renames it. 1908, a gentleman by the name of Barney Greengrass opens on 113th Street in St. Nick's. 1929, he moves his now extremely famous appetizing shop and restaurant down to 86th Street in Amsterdam,
you know,
where
so
it's
weird.
Still
I
today.
I was there during the Women's March, and I had a panic attack.
Oh, really?
And I left, and I didn't eat anything.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, so you kind of...
But luckily, I was by
you
myself.
Blanked, which I'm going to off-air refer to running out of a Jewish delicatessen as blanking, but I'll say the real person's name, but I won't on the air.
What?
You pulled a blank.
I pulled a blankety blank.
I mean, you know, it can get high intensity.
It wasn't that.
It was women and all the Jews and the locks and the
estrogen. I wasn't anxious. The people, it's not LA. It's the people. No, it was the people. They were so crazy, but the employees were really nice.
It's crazy in there. You have to be
prepared.
But
you don't really, know why I left?
Why?
Because I looked at the prices.
Oh, it's very expensive. It's very expensive.
I couldn't afford it, and I was very limited on my funds.
No, it's really expensive, but it is worth it. And I will say about Barney Greengrass, I don't think that it's nearly as good as Russ and Daughters or Russ and Daughters Cafe, but there's something about the experience there that is so quintessentially in classic New York. And because of these people who immigrated, they made it, and it's now just part of our culture.
Yeah.
You know, like even if you don't go to those places, you don't realize how much it kind of influences you.
Well, and Barney Greengrass, they also make their own bagels too, right?
I don't know. I don't think they do anymore.
So it's just
I think they might... Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to even speculate. Their bagels are not the best part of that place.
Little, yeah.
So 1938, Barney Greengrass declared the Sturgeon King by James F. Frowley, who is a state senator and one of the leaders of Tammany Hall. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because Tammany Hall and the Democratic Party that ran Tammany Hall was a pro-Irish immigrant thing. And Irish people, you know, and Jewish people weren't typically friends. So the fact that now we're 1938... We're starting to turn around where people of other cultures
are becoming friends.
And the Irish people are also extremely discriminated against. And so we're starting to see.
So were the Italians.
Exactly. And we're starting to see how everyone's starting to meld and mesh. And I thought that was actually really interesting in my reading that, you know, he didn't say he didn't declare himself the Sturgeon King. It wasn't another famous Jewish person.
The Sturgeon King.
It was
King.
This Irish senator who ran Tammany Hall. Also,
and he just
read about
declared
Tammany
himself
Hall.
The Sturgeon King.
Yeah.
He just said, oh.
No. Opposite. He declared Barney Greengrass the Sturgeon King.
He was, was nominated. I apologize.
You know, he wasn't nominated. He was just declared.
So they didn't even have laws back then against competitions?
Well, it's not a real king. Like, it's just.
Well, I'm going to start, you know what? Bretton Scott, I don't know, Galette King.
Okay, perfect.
Perfect, done.
Okay, good. We'll get shirts made up on the fly. Okay, so lox, as we were just talking about bagels, how bagels weren't traditionally a Jewish food necessarily. They had all kinds of different roots. Lox, also not a Jewish food. In Yiddish, it's called lax. In German, it's called lox. Yiddish is L-A-K-S. German is L-A-C-H-S. It's actually Scandinavian, and it was cured in salt water. It was not smoked, and it's, you know, still not, when people say smoked salmon, it's still actually not always smoked. And when it is smoked, it's cold smoked. Otherwise, it's not lox.
That's right.
Right.
That's something that I had to double check
on. A lot of times
on.
It's just cured. For instance, gravlax.
Gravlax.
Cured.
Cured in
gravlax,
salt and sugar. For
also,
those of you.
Gravlax in Scandinavian basically means grave lox because they buried it in the fucking ground. in 1873, so we're jumping back again, a gentleman by the name Pre-Horseshit. Actually, yeah, this is a little bit before.
It was starting to build up.
Right. They're like, ooh, it's getting a little stinky here.
What do you mean? I don't smell anything.
Like, we got another 20 years before it's a problem. Don't worry.
Yeah, just like global warming. Like, don't worry about it.
Anyone for a boggle?
A biagle.
So a gentleman by the name of William Alfred Lawrence is trying to make Neufchâtel?
Neufchâtel. Yeah, it's like cream cheese.
It's a cream cheese. So he's trying to make that. He's like combining things. This is happening in New York.
He's got some rennet, some milk, some curds.
It's not very stable, and there's not a lot of refrigeration. So when he first starts making it, the cream cheese situation is difficult. It's going to spoil immediately.
It's a little diapery when you're eating it.
Exactly. People are dying left and right from this fucking cream cheese. So he adds cream to the Neufchâtel thing that he kind of messes up. So this all kind of happens by accident, and he calls it cream cheese. I'm going to jump way ahead now. And the first ad, we're going to 1950, where the first ad for a bagel with butter and lox appears in Family Circle magazine. And then shortly after, Philadelphia Cream Cheese, which is owned by Kraft Foods, runs an ad for a bagel with lox and cream cheese. By the mid-1950s, Lender's Bagels have the Lender's brothers have developed a frozen, mass-produced bagel. They make a bagel baking machine. They call them the Jewish English muffins, so people will buy them.
Did they buy them? Well, of course they bought them.
Yeah, they did.
Everybody had a Lender's.
And it eventually led to the...
The fucking complete meltdown of what?
It was a complete meltdown of the Bagel Bakers Union, which, sidebar, my mom yesterday said that my uncle's father was the head of the Bagel Bakers
Union. The president of the Bagel Bakers Union.
Yeah, he was the Bagel Baker King.
Bagel Baker.
Today, jumping forward, we really are still lucky to have some really great places that are doing amazing things. Mile End over in Cobble Hill is awesome. We really love it. It's a great little Jewish deli.
You know what?
They do Montreal style.
You just said Montreal style bagels, and I wanted to share with everybody. Yesterday, I was cleaning up my freezer, and I threw away a 6-pack of St. Vertour bagels, in Montreal there's a lot of bagel shops, but there's sort of the two touristy famous ones.
Yeah.
Fairmont Bagels and then Saint Viateur. And I froze them. I bought them in November. So I kinda had them in my freezer for a long time.
Yeah, that's too long.
Too long. But they're very good. They're not as salty as an American bagel, and they're a little bit smaller, and they're very specific about the rules. The Montreal bagels have to be made in a wood-fired oven, and they have to use honey sweetened water.
Oh, wow.
And they have to be handmade.
And their hole is much bigger.
It's a little tighter.
Much bigger.
No, it's a little...
Yeah, no, it's much bigger.
Well, but tighter.
But bigger.
Yeah, but tighter.
That's the opposite.
Mm-hmm. It could be bigger and tighter.
You would know. Boz Bagels, also awesome. Frankel's in Greenpoint. And then favorite... Shelsky's, right here in Cobble Hill,
right down the street.
Yeah, wonderful appetizing place, co-owned by Peter Shelsky, who's kind enough to share some of his thoughts about growing up Jewish.
So I grew up in the 1980s, I grew up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and we were pretty secular Jews growing up. So we were like high holy day Jews. We would go to temple on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we'd go to people's bar mitzvahs when we had to go to those. And I went to Hebrew school. But I guess looking back on it, we were always Jew-ish.
Perfect.
Jew light. But that being said, our Jewishness. And my Jewishness was always mostly in relation to the food we ate. You know, we had often bagels and lox or bialys, actually, more specifically, on a very regular basis on weekends. My grandmother actually lived on the Lower East Side, right around the corner from Kozar's Bialys, is, you know, the old school original bialy bakery in New York. I have a really fond memories of going to her house and then stocking up on bialys and usually a pretzel and onion disc. And my father would put the bag of a couple dozen bialys in the trunk of his 1978 Buick Limited with velour seats.
Oh my God.
And, you know, you try to make it home and try to make it back to the Upper East Side without pulling over and you know, pulling a bialy out of the bag, and you couldn't because the smell was of freshly baked bread was wafting through the car, and so that's a really fond Jewish food memory.
He's a wonderful person, a great addition to the neighborhood, and I, you know, I'm really happy that he kind of keeps this tradition of Jewish appetizing alive. So
appetizing.
Yeah. So
I love
today,
that.
People in America eat about 5 million bagels.
Five a day.
Yeah. It's by really
5 millions.
It's really
of
crazy.
Bagelses.
So I just wanted to like briefly wrap up by asking all you guys out there to imagine the country or wherever you live or New York City, a bagel-less society. Yeah. Imagine a pizza-less society. Imagine a taco-less society.
No, I want. Stop saying those things.
Imagine a spaghetti-less
society. Stop saying those things.
Imagine a rice-less society or the worst possible outcome, a dumpling-less society.
Oh, wait. So what are we eating?
Well, without immigrants, not really very much. Bland boiled potatoes and, you know, homemade ketchup.
No, because those are not even. Those are brought from immigrants, too.
Exactly.
The Chinese, everything.
America is great and always will be great because it is a diverse place. And it is not great when we oppress and kill and push out other people. We were built on murdering Native Americans and enslaving Black people. And the best we've actually ever done is when we welcome and embrace and celebrate other people and other cultures. So if you're listening and you're eating a bagel and you're hating Mexicans, you are a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
Just put that in your pipe and smoke it. That's my take on, you know,
Amen.
Anyone out yep. there who's enjoying anything. We owe what we have and we enjoy in this country to immigrants and to their bravery for coming to a strange land and trying to make a better life and for offering like the beautiful things that they make in their own country and their own traditions so we can even have a little bit of them. And typically we just co-opt them and ruin them. But, you know, I just want to say thank you to my ancestors. I know you're probably listening from heaven or hell, wherever you may be.
There's some in purgatory. Yeah. They're still deciding.
Thank you. I appreciate you. I'm happy that we have the things we have. I feel very lucky to live in New York in a bubble and, you know, where we get to have everything. And most people are pretty appreciative and on the level. But, you know.
Delicious, wonderful things.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'd do.
I don't know.
I wouldn't eat. I'd be dead.
But really, if you're listening to this, ask yourselves. And if you have a relative out there who's standing on the wrong side of history, ask them what they would
do. True.
It's kind of an easy way to kind of segue into this conversation.
Well, I'd only eat a blade of grass.
I mean, they would just probably like be still biting right into, you know, alive pigs and getting trichomoniasis and dying. But, you know, I mean, to each his own. For me,
hey, listen, you want
for me, I like a bagel. You want trichomoniasis? See if I care. Or hey, trichinosis, listen. I should say.
I don't want to start this argument, but favorite bagel in New York.
I was going to ask you, but I'm glad you asked me.
Oh.
So one more thing, when you talk about the favorite bagel in New York, a couple of my favorite bagel shops, kind of just seeing how things have, you know, stretched, like the dough of a bagel. popular... It's widely regarded and my favorite bagel in New York City, Absolute Bagels, up on the Upper West Side near Columbia.
Very, very delicious.
Is owned by, I believe, a Thai family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And my other favorite bagel place, which I'm not sure if they're around anymore, is very famous. Was
Wait,
H&H Bagels.
Oh, H&H.
They had some kind of thing where like they sold it and I haven't been there in years.
Mm.
But they're owned by a Puerto Rican family.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it's awesome.
That?
But yeah, my favorite is Absolute.
Absolute.
What about yours?
I kind of like Bagel Hole. Bagel Hole.
Is this a porn or a place?
No, it's a bagel hole. It's a back room and on 7th
it's
Avenue.
It's at the back room of
it's
the cock?
It's in 7th, no, it's in Park, it's in South Park Slope. It's on 7th Avenue.
Oh, I know that place,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very
they
good.
They have smaller ones, smaller and tighter ones, but they also, but there's a really weird one on Father Demo Square over in the West Village where West 4th meets 6th Avenue, and it's called Bagels on the Square.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And they've always, that's when I first worked at Lupa, that's where when I worked lunches.
Yeah.
And I just moved to New York and I'm like, what do I do before? Like what's a hot sandwich? Like I just order and I remember I used to get up to the counter and psych myself up, be like, okay, like it's New York, Breton, come on, like pick up the pace. Like you got to know what you want to order. And I'd be like, I'll have a pumpernickel toasted. Right. You know, when you're nervous, the guy behind you is like, come on, buddy. And I'm like, so then like now when I go and I was like, pumpernickel bagel, double tusted scallion, double toasted. Scallion cream cheese and sliced tomatoes and sliced red onions and capers. You know, and I'm like,
hey, you talk in a heavy smoking voice.
Yeah, no, I'm like, fucking hey, asshole.
You got to.
But I was so scared when I used to order there, but they have the pumpernickel caraway bagels.
Oh my God, Marron. That's really good.
They're the best.
What's your go-to bagel order? I don't eat a lot of bagels, but I do have one. So pumpernickel double toasted. You
pumpernickel
said it.
Double toasted, and they always tell me, no, they're fresh. No, you don't want to toast it.
I don't like a toasted.
I'm sorry. Let me say that again. Pumpernickel bagel, double toasted. I just said it. That's what I meant.
Snap, girl.
Yeah, no, I like the texture better.
I like on a bagel, scallion cream cheese, lox, and some whitefish salad. Onions, capers, and tomato.
I would get lox. I just usually can't afford it.
Oh, my God.
I know.
So delicious.
I was working lunches.
Where would you go to eat your perfect / last meal of all the kind of foods that we love and have been talking about on this episode?
Murray Sturgeon Shop on the Upper West Side.
Oh my God. I thought that I was the only person that I knew who knew of that place. It's amazing. Can you tell us what you like to get there?
I'd make sure to get my Bialys from the Lower East Side, but I would go get, you know, some Nova and some pickled herring with cream sauce and onions and a few slices of sable and some scallion cream cheese, and I would toast the living hell out of the Bialy until it was virtually carbonized, and spread some scallion cream cheese on there with two slices of Nova and some sable and a few pieces of pickled herring with cream sauce and onions.
I have a question for you. What are your recommendations, chef recommends?
Don't eat anything because I said so.
What does the chef recommend to do with lox besides put it on a bagel? Go.
Well, you could wrap it around an asparagus. Ooh. Instead of like prosciutto.
Okay.
What else? You know what? Oh, I know. Do you know what those things called? Smorgasbord?
Of course.
Smorgasbord. So smorgasbord is sorry, that's just how you have to say it. It's a layer. It's like a savory Scandinavian layered cake, but okay. Made out of bread and cream cheese. But you could put so naturally, as one makes one of those every Wednesday at 10 a.m. You could wrap the outside of it, like the side of it, with a thin layer of lox, creating what would look like a rose buttercream, but it's lox. Savory. Ooh. For those of us that don't like sweet things in the morning.
Yeah.
For those of us that don't eat gluten-free pancakes in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, to hell with those. Oh,
word. Word.
Okay. That's a good chef recommends. And then I have one more question for you. About this topic in general. This is a little bit off the bagels and lox, but I just want to know, what are your top three Jewish foods?
I do love a knish.
Ooh, you know what? Knish doesn't occur to me ever, but a knish is delish.
knish is just so good. So knish is, it's traditionally mashed potatoes.
Yeah, in bread.
In a bread.
Yeah.
So if you're looking to pack on the pounds, you know, summer's over.
You're gaining weight for a roll.
Yeah, summer's over, and you just are sick of starving yourselves and eating lettuce wraps and, you know, lox. You could, put some lox on a lettuce wrap. Roll it up, you know.
Yeah, it's a lox wrap.
Shove it down, lox wrap. And, you could eat a knish.
Yeah, knish is great.
My father, his parents were Russian.
Ugh.
And my father loved his Russian foods. He loved borscht.
Mm.
So I would say we have to start with borscht.
Yum.
We have to start with finding the best beets at the farmer's market. And we have to make it into a wonderful, wonderful cold borscht soup with a big dollop of sour cream on top.
Okay, number two.
A potato latke.
Mm-hmm.
Or what do they call those? A palm roasty. But they call them something different in...
They're called latkes in
latkes
Jewish culture.
Okay,
yeah.
That's my second favorite. And then...
Sour cream or applesauce or both?
I think just sour cream.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair.
And then you did... a brisket.
Oh, yeah.
Brisket's the best.
Brisket's really good.
Brisket made me sort of turn into a Jewish food lover.
Yeah.
But I also think of brisket.
Ugh.
I always tell this funny story. I had a catering business, as you know. And
oh, really?
I did, called Love and Oven. And on Passover, I had huge quantities of Passover menus to make for people. And I decided to make a wonderful apricot burgundy brisket with apricots and burgundy. And I thought, I think this really needs some bacon to cook in it, right? To make a really wonderful taste.
Bobby.
I wasn't thinking.
Bobby put bacon in the Passover brisket. Oh my God. I can't believe it. My top three, my number one favorite Jewish food of all time, hands down, is... I know what you're going to say, I think.
What do you think I'm going
to
say?
I hope that you say my favorite thing, which I think you're going to.
Stuffed cabbage?
Of course.
Yes.
Oh my God,
like
I forgot.
My Grammy used to make with rice and meat on the inside. She put cabbage in the sauce also.
And the secret ingredient.
Ginger snaps, as my mom says.
I know Bobby already
apricots.
Told us.
It's very delicious. Smoked whitefish is my second favorite.
Delicious.
I love, 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 love smoked whitefish. And my third favorite Jewish food, I'd have to say, is matzo ball soup.
Matzo ball soup.
I love it.
Yep.
I like floaters, not sinkers.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
So that's that. Yeah, those are my questions that I have regarding Jewish foods and bagels in general.
Well, how about that? Honey sweetened.
Breton?
Yeah.
Anything? What do you got in that notepad there?
Oh, that was just the stuff that I already said. You know, the 1990s are coming. They're full. They're not coming back. They're just here.
Yeah. They're back.
And I feel really hip, like hipper than ever.
Yeah, you look a little bit hippier than ever.
Hippier, yeah. Just like kidding. My hips are really big because I've been eating
hot.
So many bagels.
No, you look hot.
I had a lot of rigatoni last night.
Do you eat a lot of bagels? I eat bagel a year.
Like once every 3-4 months. I used to eat them all the time.
Yeah, I know, me too. That's why I didn't look at
the bagels. I always said this. Here's the, like, you know, the moment on the lips. Bagels make back fat. Bagels make back fat.
Bagels make back fat. Bagels make back fat.
Yum, bagels.
But that's okay. We also like back fat. It's no problem.
I love back fat.
And I like front fat.
I have, yeah.
Should we end?
Yeah.
Back fat is great.
Is delicious. Well, you know what? Sear it up, slice it up, render in the pan.
I wanted to ask you.
Make your popcorn inside my hand. Dip it up, butter it up, put it by a movie.
Was that a freestyle?
Yeah, I'm actually.
What are you doing sitting here? Why are you? Yeah, why are you doing a podcast? You should be on the road.
Well, that's really funny. I'm going to Midtown right now to do some voice recording.
Okay, good.
Some freestyling.
Perfect. This wasn't going well anyway. I feel like we should just stop doing the podcast. It's boring. Nobody likes it.
All right. So coming to conclusion.
Yes.
Go get yourself your nearest bagel. I can't say the word bagel.
Yes,
you are
saying the word bagel, but you are supposed to say bagel.
Okay, so I'll go back to my old accent from Wisconsin. Like, that's how I grew up talking, kind of like this.
Okay.
And when I was younger, I used to say, like, oh, I'll have a bagel with cream cheese. And then people, when I moved here, I obviously didn't talk like this. And I would say, oh, like, hey, guys, can I get a bagel? And everybody's like, they're like, oh my God, like, you say the word bagel so funny. And I still, to this day, don't know how to say the word bagel.
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 Correct.
So I'm saying it correct? Bagel?
Of course. Who am I to talk any shit on you? You hear how I talk?
Yeah, but that's like...
You hear how I talk? You hear how I talk? I go to Wisconsin, people are like, what are you saying?
Bagel. You say bagel, and I say bagel. You say lox, and I say
fox. If you had a message for kids who are Mexican-Americans right now and who are going to school and being teased... and taunted and talked about, seeing you as a daughter of an immigrant who was teased and taunted in school and in an age where Jews weren't necessarily accepted, what would be your advice for a young kid today, how to get through and kind of persevere through some of that hatred?
Well, my first thought, and again, being a psychologist, I think of fear. And I would like to tell a child who's experiencing discrimination that the other people are filled with fear and they just don't know, and it's ignorance and fear, and that they have to believe in themselves and know that it's what the other person is saying to them is not really about them. It's about their own fear. So it's about the other person's fear, not about their own inadequacy or something wrong with them or they're being different. We're all different. Every single one of us is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're all our own recipe.
I can tell you that you've got, and I only speak as a New Yorker, You've got a city with 8+ million people who not only feel your pain but are ready with open arms. Come to New York. We want you. We need you. And the best advice is come be with everyone from all over the world in a great place where generally we all get along.
I've heard of Anne Frank. Yes. Yeah.
Part of what I remember is how they'd have little pieces of cake wrapped up and then they would share little teeny pieces of it, and how just the little teeny flavors of it were so important, and it was their culture and it was part of what, when they felt that they had things and even when they didn't, they could still remember when they had things, so remembering abundance when you don't have abundance is a way to get through it.
Absolutely.